so we would take that practice to the client offices where it would be 2:30 and we'd say, hey, who wants to go for a coffee walk? And, you know, we get the VP of engineering, we get the directors, we get people to just go out and have this, like, we need to just rip you away from the keyboard just for a minute.
Yes.
To just let some thoughts settle, to share some things, to get some feedback, to just whatever that magic is when people are in motion together.
Yeah.
And it was a value add of taking that break, walking away, and then coming back in with a fresh mind, fresh perspectives, fresh momentum. I mean, if you want to write great software, get a good pair of walking shoes, seriously.
Welcome to the Reliability Rebels podcast, where we improve production by challenging the status quo. Your host, Armin Astani from Cherto Modo.
Check one, check two.
Reliability Rebels.
Check one, check two.
Reliability Rebels.
Check.
Reliability Rebels.
Welcome to the Reliability Rebels podcast, where we explore how to make software and systems more reliable by challenging the status quo. I'm your host, Amin Astani. Welcome to our inaugural episode, and thanks so much for joining us. Let's take a couple moments to discuss the format a little bit, a word from our sponsor, and then introduce our guest. So practices like DevOps and site reliability engineering involve a lot of change leadership. As in, we're guiding a team, a department, or even a company through significant changes. To improve the reliability of our systems, we sometimes have to challenge assumptions, past decisions, existing technology, and even company culture. This podcast will explore real-life examples with our guests and reveal insights and techniques applicable to your career and team. Before we get started, a quick word from our sponsor. Hey, Amin here. Are you a tech founder, engineering leader, or product manager concerned about launching, running, or scaling your SaaS product and infrastructure? If your team's currently struggling with painful outages, interruptions, angry customers, and maybe even customer churn, you'll want to hear this. I run a tech consultancy called Cherto Modo. I designed it to not be just another tech consulting firm. I bring 15 years of real-world experience in cloud systems engineering, DevOps, and SRE. I've been in the thick of it, working with both scrappy startups and big tech giants, and I know what it takes to keep your products running smoothly and your customers happy. My approach is direct, effective, and proven, building a reputation as a trusted partner who gets things done. If reducing costs and headaches running your SaaS product sounds good to you, visit CertoModo.io, that's CertoModo.io, and schedule an intro call. Thanks so much. All right, back to the show. Let's get back into it. I'm glad to introduce our first guest, Rick Gorman, a software engineer based in Vegas with a very diverse background. Bitcoin, bootstrapping a startup, and now working for a healthcare company doing full stack work, dev and ops. I love that. Thanks for joining me.
I'm in. Thanks for having me on.
Rock on. So tell us a little more about yourself. I didn't want to steal your thunder and reveal all the details about you.
Yeah. You know, I'll give you the short and the thick of it. I took the long road into software engineering. Started by getting really excited at a young age about basically multiplayer gaming. It was StarCraft.
Nice.
Before StarCraft, it was Warcraft 2.
Mm-hmm.
Had some buddies who had this home network, and they're a little bit older. They tutored us kids in networking and basic, like, how to do stuff with Turbo C, and got me really stoked, really excited about this. Graduated high school, went to college for CompSci, immediately got sucked into playing a lot of Counter-Strike. And I think it was like the fourth time that I dropped out, I decided, you know what, this isn't, like, school's not for me.
Sure.
So I worked my way up from doing tech support, customer service, sysadmin work, just finding whatever job I could. I worked in this guy's attic working on, like, some shopping cart app that I don't know. It was a job and it paid money and I learned a little bit from it and eventually pivoted my way through customer service management, through IT management, did a bunch of DevOps right when the cloud was taken off.
Oh, wow.
You know, the real early stuff, there was no Terraform. There was no, like, Chef was the big thing back then. CF Engine was the really up and coming, it's going to be a thing. And
yeah, that's right.
Didn't really, it was way too abstract.
It was C-based too.
Nobody wants to write scripts in C.
No.
I worked for a company that did streaming media and we took it, it was one of those explosive growth moments. The company was growing like 50, 60% year over year.
Wow.
Stayed there for about 4.5 years, worked my way into, it was like in between product development, customer service, analytics, I don't know, every which thing. There's so many problems. One of those startups of wearing many hats.
Yeah, I can relate.
Right. It just, there's never enough talent to do what needs to be done. And I got really excited with doing analytics. That was the coolest thing ever. Got really deep into Postgres. I was doing Ruby on Sinatra.
Yeah.
And just building these just dummy little things with like Google Charts to show like viewership data. And that to me was like, that was the coolest thing. Sales guys are asking these questions. Nobody else knows. I was able to just dig into the code, figure out like what is going on, bring some actionable things up, you know, make some change happen, and do that with data in a way where it's not like, you know, hey, look at me, I've got so-and-so degree from so-and-so prestigious place and look at my pedigree and you should do this.
Mm-hmm.
No, like here's the data. The data's speaking.
You're speaking my language, man. That's fantastic. So what are you doing now?
Fast forward a bunch of years. I managed to take a 4-year sabbatical. Got lucky with Bitcoin early on, got into meditation and just kind of, I tried like everything I could possibly try, wound up, you know, I burned through my stash. I was doing drywall and demo work and my gym buddy told me, hey, there's this boot camp. They'll teach you Ruby on Rails. They won't charge you a dime until you get paid. They take a fraction of your salary. And that just, this light bulb went off. Like those guys are optimized. They've got, like they know what they're doing. And moved to New York, learned Rails, worked for a few companies, Rails consultancy called Thoughtbot, worked there for a bit.
Oh, yeah.
And since then I've worked in an acquired startup that was just Ruby on Rails on Heroku with one dyno, Postgres database, and currently working at a company called Florence Healthcare in the clinical trial space doing, it's full stack. It's up and down. It's messing with views. It's messing with database. It's messing with operability and every piece in between while working in a environment where the company is growing in a bunch of different directions and there are competitors and there are multiple tech stats and tech debt is starting to become a thing. That's a serious conversation. And the economy's in this like really interesting pivot thing, especially this week. The Fed rate's starting to drop. So VC is going to start lighting up. And so they're, you know, it's a really interesting place, a lot of unknowns. And, you know, I'm sitting on this question of what's the best way to, because it's always going to be a risk to start a piece of change with the unknowns, but what's the best path forward?
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. I really appreciate you going through your background with me in such great detail. You're speaking my language. I think it's so important that when you are doing engineering work and you are working with other teams, you're going back to the data, right? It isn't a matter of sentiment. And yes, currently interest rate did drop. Lots of things happened this week, a very eventful week. So there are a lot of unknowns, what to focus on, what to do. So let's dig a little bit deeper. Of course, this podcast is about reliability. When did you start to have concern on that aspect?
So I'll tell you a story about a service that and maybe this is a common thing people have bumped into. It's a service on the V1 API. It's a service that's been up for a long time. That works. It does its job. It's a little flakier than desired, but you can work with it. You can find ways of getting the service to work.
Yeah.
There's a V2 that is in the works, doesn't have a target delivery date yet. It's going to replace V1, and it's going to get the job done.
Sure.
My team is really dependent on that V1 service, and it fails sometimes, and we don't know why it fails sometimes. And
interesting.
There's, there's one, there's a scarcity of people to work on it. One, a lot of the people who built it are no longer with the company.
Absolutely.
That knowledge has walked out the door. Mm-hmm. Two, there's a lot of momentum to build the new version of the service. And it's this slow motion deprecation. My team jumped on to use it late in the game. And right. So we're not the consumer that it was designed around. And getting, how do you phrase it? Getting mixed results out of an API, we have to build things like retries where maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work. We got to do a little introspection into it. And there's, at some point it gets to be like, how much retry of that service and its dependent services is actually worth crafting in order to get the job done, as opposed to just saying, sorry, customer, you're going to have a deeper conversation with sales, maybe risk churn at an early point in the relationship. But business-wise, that might be the correct choice. I'm not sure. But that's, one point that the tech debt has brought to light as of late.
Yeah, totally. I can so relate to this. In a past life, I worked at a company where they had a internal hosting platform, and it ran great to a point, to a certain scale. And then, of course, there was the prompt to build the new thing. And it took a long time to build the new thing. There was a lot of Snowflake features on the old thing that a lot of customers wanted, and getting it to map to the feature set on the new thing was a pain in the butt. And there was certainly a lot of glue code, as you mentioned, to keep things working, even though you're dealing with a aging, crufty piece of technology where, yes, the engineers that designed it are out the door. They've been gone for years. So I feel like I'm talking to myself almost. This is kind of an eerie conversation.
You said the word glue code.
Yes.
That reads to me as, I'm just going to write this code, and it's just going to be temporary. It's just going to I'm just like taping something to the wall. Don't worry, we're going to fix that later, I promise.
I mean, sure. I mean, that is very much like the source of tech debt, which is one of those things that I know you're really passionate about. So tell me a little bit more about this tech debt piece, because I know it's been the axe that you're grinding, the current mission that you're on. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about it? How do you reason about it? How have you tried to address it?
Mm-hmm. Tech debt is, it will always happen. It's always there, and it's always there because the business is always pivoting.
Yes.
Right. Code is just like, okay, let's codify the way the business works right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to work great until the business shifts. Businesses always shift. That's the nature of it. To be competitive, there's just this constant shifting. And so just by default, tech debt will always accumulate.
Mm-hmm.
It's there's no code. I mean, I would love to see a piece of code. Maybe like cat hasn't changed in like 50 years, right? It just like spits out a text file. But then we had Unicode that came out that started breaking everything. So there's always this need to continuously modify and change things. And so, I can list a whole bunch of things I've seen that don't work.
Let's have some examples.
Yeah. So something that doesn't work is copy and pasting features and then tweaking one tiny bit on the new piece of it.
Sure. Yeah.
Or adding like another if else statement.
Yeah.
You ever see a piece of code like that?
I've seen many pieces of code like that with nested or chained if statements that are very hard and painful to read. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When I was cutting my teeth on C back in the 90s, inheritance was this great thing. And you know, C in 21 days, C++ in 21 days, they talk about inheritance. It's this amazing ability to push behavior down into child classes. And
yeah,
in the real world, inheritance winds up being awful. it creates this system of trying to make things fit a mold.
Sure. I feel so validated right now because I've had some more OOP experts look at my code over the years and almost tease me for writing my code too procedurally. So I feel very validated in this moment. Yeah. Thank you.
No, pure functions are the future. They've been with us for a while. But, you know, even in infrastructure code, you know, let's say you got to support like a legacy node version on some of your services.
Okay.
So let's create, you know, a piece of config and name it, you know, legacy node 16.
Gross, right? But okay. Gotcha.
So it's going to have some attributes in it that maybe differ from the, you know, the live version of node.
Yep.
But some of them are the same. And so as things evolve, now things have to be changed in two places to keep it up to date.
Correct.
And the person who wrote it, you know, there's a good chance that that's going to be in working memory. That person moves to a different role, leaves the company. Who knows what's been copy-pasted anymore? That knowledge just walks out the door. And unless you've got great testing or you've got great observability or you've got some kind of process for, you know, for programmatically double checking this, stuff just starts breaking.
Oh, 100%. I think we've seen lots of examples of this, particularly over the last couple years where there's been a huge wave of layoffs. So spontaneously, a person that was responsible for a particular component of code or a feature or something, they disappear into the ether.
They're gone.
And all of that organizational knowledge, all of that context, all of the problems and challenges that were in their mind to solve have now been dropped on the floor for other engineers to basically rediscover, usually at the most inopportune times.
Yeah. And that's, you know, as far as, I mean, that is the problem of not knowing where the problems are.
Right.
And being on a deadline, right? The company has a competitor. We think their feature is going to be out by the end of Q2. We need to match that. We need to beat that. We're working on our feature sets. We're burning through our tickets. And now the tech debt, I don't know. I don't want to call it a demon, but you know, the ugly head is raised of this can't be extended any further. This needs to be rewritten. This isn't going to hold together anymore. Like, we can't put any more bondo on the situation to keep it working. And it winds up being this struggle. You know, if you have a great engineering manager, they can work with you.
Correct.
And so there's this balance of engineering versus product versus sales of, is everybody an equal partner? Is it a sales-driven organization? Is it product-driven? And those questions wind up leading to different answers of, do things get paid off? Do you put a Band-Aid on it? Do you just not get the feature out of the door? Do you go back to pre-sales to work another set to be able to capture that customer and like go to a competitor instead?
So listeners, Rick gets it. Just taking an aside and mentioning this. So in my mind, I remember the days when you had sales and you had support and you had engineering and you had product, and they all have their own set of incentives and they have their own perception about what problems to solve. And usually they have completely different pictures in their heads. So being able to create consensus across those groups as to even what the problem is very difficult. And then even more difficult is being able to decide on a course of action that gets the organization out of the hole. I mean, this is very much the crux of you know, in my mind, the organizational problems and dysfunction that plague software engineering or like SaaS companies today is just misaligned incentives. It's just amazing to hear someone articulate it so well from a slightly different standpoint. But I feel validated in that I'm not the only one thinking about this problem. That's awesome.
Right. And that's a piece of it is there's this siloing that happens where, I mean, how many people are going to be in your role or my role at any given company?
Right.
There's you know, it's a small set.
Correct.
And that, I don't know if it's an imposter syndrome or if it's a like, well, it's, you know, all it's just, it's my problem. I'm not good enough. I obviously have a bunch of faults and it's my fault that the system works this way. And so I need to feel guilty and I need to just do whatever is, management's telling me to do. And it turns out that if you take a step back and you talk with other people in similar roles at similar companies or even different companies, this is a common thread of this struggle between, you know, the big three, if we're going to call them that, the sales, the product, and the engineering orgs.
Right. So one salesperson that I knew for a long time, gave me a good piece of wisdom and I carry it with me, you know, as I work with companies. Teams tend to make the best decisions that they can with the information they have on hand at the time. And what ends up happening is, you know, 6 to 12 months down the line, you have a new set of information, up-to-date information, and you realize that change back there wasn't necessarily the best choice. But in that moment, you did not know that. So it's important, listeners, to have some compassion for yourself or have some grace for the teams that work with you that, you know, took calls or made decisions that in the moment don't sound very, you know, effective or smart. But again, in that moment, it probably was the best thing for the business.
You know, that's real, man. That's, because it's real easy to build up this mentality of whoever came before me was just bad.
Yeah,
they wrote bad code. They made bad decisions. Because in 6 months, that's going to be you.
That's right.
Right. And it leads to this, this like burnout piece, which is one of the things I've been working to fight a good chunk of my career is building software, building teams, building infrastructure. Like, how do you build basically a SaaS company where people want to stick around longer?
Oh yeah. That is the challenge.
How does it work? How can you do that? What gets in the way of people sticking around?
100%. I mean, I built my consultancy Chertomoto around that question. It's amazing to have this conversation with you because yes, there is this inflection point in a business, usually when the sales organization is really strong, they're bringing in a lot of customers and there is a lot of demand for the engineering team to deliver on commitments. And I'm not necessarily talking about vaporware here. I'm talking about, you know, some minor tweaks to sign the deal, something that is within reach. But you have tons of those happening in quick succession. And that is usually when the engineering team is starting to feel friction, when they're dealing with, you know, little problems that have now grown in scale to very large ones. They're dealing with a lot of toil in the SRE space. We talk about manual tasks that are non-value add. We call that toil. The toil adds up when the number of customers, you know, increase. It's like a linear relationship when it's an organization that's immature and it's before, you know, their DevOps or SRE transformation or whatever you want to call it. How do you address that? That really is the problem. And it seems that you and I both have very similar missions in that regard.
Yeah, I've got a thesis I've been working on. Working to either disprove it or find other reasons why it's correct. And it's to have empathy for yourself and for the team and for the future versions of yourself and to write code in a way where you can pick it up in 6 months.
Amen.
When I was in my 20s, I didn't forget anything. I could remember. It was like this crazy memory I was blessed with. And sure, I could pick up a piece of code, I could pick up a system, and I knew every bit and piece of it.
Yeah.
Fast forward a bit, and like, I can't tell you what I ate for lunch today. I don't know what tickets I worked on this week. I'd have to go back and look at the list. And so just knowing that, that like, you know, on my best day, I'm going to have good memory. Mm-hmm. But on my average day, I'm going to have gaps in my memory. And so if I'm going to go look at code again, what type of code do I want to look at it? Whether it's, you know, infrastructure code or it's feature code, something where it's well crafted. It reads closer to English. I'm a Ruby guy, so that's part of our shtick. Is
respect.
It reads closer to English than most other languages. It's high level. It's modifiable, so I can go in. I can easily see what is being injected into a service. Like if I'm operating on a bunch of widgets, okay, I've got a widget class that I'm shipping into it by default. Maybe I'll ship in like new widget class and it's the same shape. It's basically the same interface.
Sure.
And I can pick that up. I can use it. I've got great tests. So if I'm not sure how something works, I can go look at a unit test to see how something's being invoked. I can go to a system test. I can see how something's being used by a user. I've got like a bunch of references and they also serve to prove the correctness of a system. So there are two sides of an argument in the Rails community around, do you test associations on models? Mm. And, you know, small context here, let's say we've got a user, we've got articles and we've got comments.
Sure.
So a user has many articles and an article has many comments.
Makes sense.
Right. So in the model, the user model, you would see user has many articles. That's the way it would be written. In the spec for that model, there's a question of, well, should we even bother testing that? Because the test is just going to have the contents of it. The test is going to say it should have many articles.
Right.
So that we're duplicating the code back and forth.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I mean, so just to play devil's advocate, because I think we need to explore this a little bit, you know, how much is too much, right? Because there's, mm-hmm. there's a spectrum mm-hmm. and we're trying to find the right balance here. So on one side of the spectrum, you have code that is, you know, YOLO. I'm just writing stuff. I'm not necessarily testing it, or I might do manual tests on my local environment. I'm pushing it to production. We don't have any discipline. Right. And of course, that's going to be prone to a lot of problems in terms of being able to know that your code actually works. It's not being monitored. You don't have tests. That's one side of the spectrum. On the other side of the spectrum, you can have so many tests, so much observability, you know, so many gates on the path to ship into prod that your ability to, you know, release business value and be competitive is hampered. Mm-hmm. So like, how do we find that middle ground? And I, of course, have, you know, my own philosophy about that, but I'm very interested in hearing yours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to write tests that keep me from shooting myself in the foot.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to put that piece of code in that it should have many articles. Mm-hmm. And that's there as a warning that if I go in and change that piece of code later, like, well, maybe it belongs to many articles. Maybe an inverse relationship makes more sense to me in, you know, some 2 a.m. coding sprint and I just want to ship that, like I'm going to get a little nudge from my past self like, hey, are you sure you want to do that?
Yeah.
You know, this is kind of why, you know, at least there's some kind of a brace there. I can go dig into that PR. I can look at the notes. I can mm-hmm. see why it was built in the first place. And, you know, maybe it is better to have an inverse relationship. Maybe not. And I really roll with that philosophy of, am I shooting myself in the foot with this?
Yeah.
Something I learned at some point in my career, I wanted to have around an external API I was accessing, I wanted to have like three or four different levels of abstraction.
Interesting.
Right? Like I want to have something that's going to do the HTTP stuff. I want to have something that's going to do the JSON validation. I want to have something that's going to do some logic around it. I want to have something that maps that into my model inside of the monolith.
Okay, reasonable.
Right, so I got four levels of that. So now I've got four pieces of testing that I need to do.
Yes, you do.
Right? And so it goes from being, you know, four files. Now I've got eight files I got to work on.
Yes.
And maybe realistically, all I need is a system spec around it. Like, maybe all I need is something that mocks out the endpoint and, okay, I've got this thing and I was able to map it into my model and persist it. Cool. Like that's 80% of the way there for it being tested. It's one file for the whatever, for the service, one file for the spec. If things start shifting later, right, there's like different responses that come back from this endpoint. Okay, maybe I'm going to test a little bit better. Maybe it needs to get mapped onto two different models later down the road. Okay, I'm going to introduce a mapper and, you know, slowly as the thing gets more complicated, add more specs on, but do it in a way where it's not engineered ahead of time.
Right. Yeah. You're alluding a little bit to an old model from Martin Fowler called the testing pyramid, where the idea is that most of your tests are unit tests and then there's like a lesser, quantity that is integration tests. And then, you know, on the top, it's kind of like, you know, the food pyramid, the smallest quantity is going to be your end to end tests. But I think what you're mentioning here is that you do really need to pay attention to where those end to end tests really provide a lot of value and eliminate a lot of work. You know, maybe the pyramid as originally described isn't quite the right, you know, proportions in all cases. And I've heard debate about that, but interesting to share.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I mean, happy path is a great thing to test.
Yes.
You know, the majority of where, it, like the 80-20 rule, right?
Sure.
Like, let's just capture whatever we can in the smallest amount of code, use the power law to our advantage. Most users are going to do the same thing. I don't know, the tests in our Rails monolith for the admin routes are just that, like, it shows a 200, like it doesn't crash. There's not a bad filter config or something.
Sure.
It's not testing every single admin route that can happen.
Yeah.
If something breaks, okay, an admin lets us know, we can fix it, we can iterate out. We're closer to those users and that's fine. That's worked. It got a company acquired in less than 3 years. It's a workable thing.
Yes.
And so there's that sense of like, yeah, where do I need to put my test? What test do I need to write? Where do I need to focus on it? And I mean, you know, my general advice is happy path, test that all the time.
Sure.
And also test it with your services, test it with your models, your smaller units, like test the happy path.
Yeah.
And then if you can come up with some context of here's an odd case or here's the null case or whatever, like test those.
Yeah.
You don't have to test every single combination of every single thing. If you've got four different if statements and so you wind up with 8 or 16 different code paths, like, do you really need to test every single, you know, maybe that's a sign that it could be re-architected,
right,
with dependency injection, different story, but, some tests are better than no tests.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed. I mean, one of the things that immediately comes to mind is there are tests and then there's observability. And, you know, from my standpoint as a site reliability engineer, one of the biggest tools that we use all the time is the practice of service level objectives. And in a sense, it's kind of like testing in production, where you are defining, here are the customer's expectations in terms of their user flow or their user journey. What is it that they're expecting to do successfully when they're using the app? And we're not even talking about metrics at first. It's like, I want to put panel A into slot B in this app here. And if I can't, then, okay, the engineering team should be alerted about it. So that is definitely one of the ways to tackle that stuff. So that way you're not testing every single instance, but you are crafting your monitoring in production around how customers actually use your stuff. And then you get notified when they can't do that. And that usually maps to the actual business outcomes rather than, you know, like the percentage of test coverage or whatever. So when you're getting started, that's a great place to focus. No, this is awesome. I really appreciate you just working through your philosophy around, you know, testing, where to test, you know, what is enough, not shooting yourself in the foot. That That's huge. I don't like foot guns either. So speaking of foot guns, tell me an instance where the foot gun did go off. It was a really bad day, you know, for the product or the team, if that's something that you can share. What's the, you know, the instance of, you know, something that went wrong?
Yeah, no, that's a great, great question. There was an API that the team was using that was, it was something that the legally the business relied upon.
Okay.
We were not using, I'm keeping it vague to try to not pinpoint this.
No worries.
We were using the API improperly.
Okay.
We didn't know this. And all of a sudden there was a timeout on the API where like that object was only going to be persisted for so many days.
Oh, wow.
And all of a sudden we lost, you know, it was like these things just started rolling away. We didn't notice this. So it was like it took days for that to be realized. Like our foreign objects are gone.
Oh, so this is a data loss incident.
It's a data loss. It's an integrity loss that like we legally had some bindings on these remote objects.
Oh my goodness. That's a toughie.
That was, you know, no one knew about this. Nobody had any clue. We didn't have, you know, small scrappy startups like you're saying oftentimes don't have more mature observability around things that are working, things that aren't working, things that should be there, right. SLAs, SLOs. And so that just one day, I don't know who it was, but somebody just started like cussing and like, what's going on? And, you know, I think we wound up having like the, you know, the VP of ops, VP of engineering, like everybody's just kind of huddling around, like what can we possibly do here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so funny. Yeah, some teams, you know, they measure latency, they measure error rate, but what you're talking about is WTFs per minute, right? If the WTFs per minute right. is too high, I saw this in a comic and it just makes me laugh. If the WTFs per minute exceeds a certain threshold, you know that something's really wrong with production. I mean, it seems to have worked in this instance, but how long did the data loss situation persist until humans discovered this was happening? Like how long was this going on?
Yeah, that was, I don't know, maybe a week.
Oh my goodness.
Something like that. I think there was,
wow.
You know, someone, you know, an internal admin was trying to build something and they couldn't. And, you know, and that was on behalf of a customer request. And
oh boy.
So that's like the business just stopped there, that legally we weren't able to continue. And, you know, and it, you know, to give them credit, like it was a pretty blameless situation. It was, okay, you know, we took a risk using this external service in the first place.
Sure, yeah.
We used it as best as we could.
Mm-hmm.
We communicated with the support team of that API provider. They talked us through the way to use it, which turns out we were like not using it properly.
Oh, wow, okay.
And so there's this timeout that was just like, it wasn't in the docs or anything. It just happened. And
oh, wow.
So, you know, at the end of the day, like, you know, it could be, oh, you guys should have known better. Shame on you. You're all fired. Get out of here. No, it was, okay, well, like, what's the best thing we can do going forward to fix this? How can we check these things? How can we, like, refresh these things? How can we, like, create some observability into where that timeout might be in the future so that we can act accordingly?
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, blameless. Right. So important. Because the moment that you start pointing fingers, teams and individuals tend to hide.
100%.
Right. They tend to hide the details, and then you're not able to drill down into, you know, I don't like using the term root cause, but the contributing factors to why, you know, the incident took place. So that's really awesome that your organization, you know, has those cultural values, because it's a big piece, you know, of the puzzle. So did you do an actual postmortem for this, or was it like an informal thing? Like, how do you do that? How do you tie the loop where you, for every incident or incidents like that, which are major, you're learning from failure?
Yeah. So, you know, I'll speak a little more generally.
Sure.
You know, I've done a good amount of consulting, worked with a bunch of different companies around this, and there's no one way to do this.
Of course
it's
not.
Some companies like to do the formal 5-why process where there's a a neutral facilitator who is able to dig in without bias to try and figure out, okay, is it an operational issue? Is it like, why is this actually happening?
Yes.
Get to the root, or get to some lower level cause of it, and try and, patch the system so that one person can't make that mistake and turn everything into goo.
Yeah. Like, Poke Yoke from Toyota Production System, automation with the human touch. You're making it difficult for humans to cause harm with technology. That makes sense. Yeah, 5 whys. I mean, when we're all getting started in like the Agile or the DevOps journey, 5 whys comes up. But over the past decade, there's been a lot of new stuff out there, like John Allspaugh and his resilience engineering, type thing, where he's written a ton of articles about like, here's why not to use 5 whys, or Ishikawa, the fishbone diagrams or all that stuff. But if for lack of a better tool, 5 whys is a great place to start. It's better than pointing a finger, right? But no, fair enough. That is definitely one of those approaches.
At the end of it, these are all tools to try to create humility in the team that, I just remember in the comp sci department, there was this air of people trying to outsmart each other and trying to appear intelligent, and a lot of
ego,
boasting and ego, mm-hmm. and justification. And it's, let me explain your worldview to you, that type of attitude.
For sure.
And that's great in academia. Maybe it's not. It persists there in some places. But in the real world, where there's, money and pace and time that, we just can't afford to have those things. And so something like 5 whys, I think it's good for creating some humility in the room of like, maybe we don't know why. Maybe we've only in our head gone down 2 levels, and going down another couple levels makes us start thinking, oh, I wasn't thinking about that. Or, oh, this wasn't even evident. Oh, there's this other thing. Oh, it's a bigger problem space. Oh, we didn't know that ops had this deadline. Oh, we didn't know that product has this, whatever it is. So, at the end of the day, that's the culture that a good blameless postmortem, I think, creates, is just that space. Like, just to say, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't have a clue, and I'm not going to make something up to make myself look better, to try to create space. Like, I'm just going to let there be a vacuum. Like, I don't know.
Yes. Yeah. And then start asking questions, and eventually you come to the truth, or at least a pretty close enough approximation of it. This is huge. Blameless. Yeah. Having a blameless postmortem process, and it can take many forms. I, of course, talk about, the one from Facebook where they do something called DERP. You ever heard of this? So for every postmortem that they do, they write it out in a format that is detection, which is, how did they figure out that the incident's happening in the first place, through monitoring or someone reported it. You have escalation, the process of getting the problem to the right people in order to solve it. You have remediation, which is, what do they do to, stop the bleeding? And then prevention, which is, what action items do you do in order to prevent the issue from happening again? And that, I think in the P step is where, you're doing like 5 whys, and you're thinking about the process and technology failures. And it's really key, just for listeners to understand, that when you are doing blameless postmortems, you're talking about process and technology failures, not people. If in your postmortem document, the words human error is written anywhere on the document, you need to erase it and try again, because that's not really a contributing factor to an incident. Usually it is a piece of technology that has failed, or a process that has failed. We don't point fingers. Cool. Yeah, that all makes sense. And again, that's really awesome that you have this culture, and I think 5 whys is a good place to start. And there's like a huge amount of books that talk about this subject and what the techniques du jour are. And again, resilience engineering is a very interesting subject that really gets into it.
Yeah, something to throw there that, you know, regardless of the process, there are going to be all these local maxima of, you know, maybe Five Wise is a local maxima, maybe DERP is a local maxima. People come up with other processes that work, but the gist is creating this culture where people aren't afraid at their jobs.
That is right.
Right.
Psychological safety.
Sitting there and I'm writing code and I'm starting to think about if I write it this way, this person's going to yell at me. If I write it this way, this person's going to say, no, you can't do that. If I write it this way, somebody's going to get angry. If I write it this way, maybe I'm going to get fired. It just creates this space where, okay, there's only one really narrow way in which I can write code. And, you know, as a human, I like to express myself. I like to be colorful. I like to, you know, put a little bit of energy and emotion in my work.
100%.
And that blameless culture, I mean, you know, assuming people are learning and people aren't malicious and people are, you know, being as competent as they can be, it creates the space of like, yeah, let's all do our best work together. Let's collaborate. Let's, you know, synergize. Let's come up with new, cool solutions. Let's have a culture where we can take risks.
Yes.
And we're supported. And maybe we fail because sometimes you take a risk and you fail. It's, 100%. You know, that's part of the game.
It is.
And we're not punished for doing that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You are speaking my language. You're describing psychological safety here. You've described psychological safety in a way that I haven't thought about it before. Psychological safety in just the day-to-day work, how you go about your creative process, because writing software is a creative process.
We're creating stuff.
We are taking ideas and we're turning it into software that solves people's problems, and that, you know, is a privilege that we're able to do. And, you know, when you were describing like, I can't code this way, I can't code this way, I, you know, my blood pressure was going up. I was feeling like, wow, if I worked in an environment like that, it would be really constraining. It would be very stressful. We should leave engineers to be free to be themselves so that they're able to do their best work. And sure, if something goes wrong, there's an opportunity to learn. But again, it's not about pointing fingers. But I never thought about, you know, having a blameless culture, having psychological safety, being important in the creative process. I'm usually thinking about it as part of like the incident response and learning from failure loop. So that's really interesting. I appreciate you sharing that perspective. It's huge.
It's, you know, I'll tell you, one of the wildest things about working at Thoughtbot, this is Rails consultancy.
Yeah, familiar with it.
We every day would go on a coffee walk, which actually it turned out it was more of a cookie walk. There's this great place, Midtown Manhattan, that had these cookies that were just like wait in line for 15 minutes to get a cookie. And
all right, yeah.
We would, it was like at, you know, 2:30 in the afternoon, somebody would pop their head up like coffee walk, cookie walk, cookie walk, cookie walk. And then everybody would just huddle and we get, you know, 10 or 15 people to go spend, you know, at least 20, 25 minutes out walking about. There were some days where we would go sit in the park.
Sure.
And just hang out in Bryant Park for 2-3 hours and just be talking about what's going on with different clients, what's going on with different projects. Here's some problems we're bumping into. And it didn't happen every day, but you know, maybe once every couple of weeks that would happen. And so we would take that practice to the client offices where it would be 2:30 and we'd say, hey, who wants to go for a coffee walk? And you know, we get the VP of engineering, we get the directors, we get people to just go out and have this like, we need to just rip you away from the keyboard just for a minute.
Yes.
To just let some thoughts settle, to share some things, to get some feedback, to just whatever that magic is when people are in motion together.
Yeah.
And it was a value add of taking that break, walking away, and then coming back in with a fresh mind, fresh perspectives, fresh momentum. I mean, if you want to write great software, get a good pair of walking shoes, seriously.
That's the quote. That's the quote of the episode. Folks, that's fantastic. What you're reminding me of, you know, I think a lot about like agile methodologies because I'm one of those big nerds to think about that stuff. So there is something called the Gemba walk. You probably have heard of it. No?
No.
Gemba Walk? So you got the cooler one. I like Cookie Walks better, so I'm going to do that instead. But Gemba Walks was this concept where, you know, the manager would walk around and actually be where the work is done. And the point behind that is to observe the actual conditions that are in the field where the work is done in order to identify, you know, pain points with their employees, things that are really frustrating them. So, and that reveals opportunities for improvement that is spontaneous, that is conversational, and it's not confrontational. You're just going and looking, and you're like, what's that? And you're asking questions. You're being curious, and you're revealing really interesting tidbits about the nuance of what it takes to do their job. And there might be some things that are like really painful that they're just accepting because it's always been that way. But you having a third-party perspective, an objective perspective, can say, hold up, what is this? And you can fix it. But now add cookies. I love that. I need to get more cookies. I think I should do that with my clients. I think that's fantastic.
Cookies good.
Cookies good. Cookie walks. That's fantastic. Wow. Thank you for sharing. So, all right, we have a couple more questions before we wrap up. Let's talk about some interesting stuff. Like, what's keeping you up at night right now? Like, what's the big struggle? Like, I know we were talking about technical debt, and you're passionate about that. And I'm assuming you're passionate about it because you're fighting it right now. Like, talk to me a little bit about, you know, what's going on there. Maybe I might have some interesting tidbits to share.
Yeah. So I've had the privilege my career. I've worked at two places for 4+ years each.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It's really cool to find a place. I mean, you know, our grandparents, this is how it worked, right? You work at a company for 10, 20, 30 years.
Get the watch.
Pretty normal.
Yeah.
These days in tech, average tenure is 18 to 24 months. People are just, well, last couple of years, maybe slightly different, but people are just hopping shop, right? It's like, I'm not getting the promotion I want. I'm not getting the salary I want. But if I go over there, I can get a 15% bump. And there's this tenure issue. But people also drop out because the quality of the developer experience just, it drops month after month, year after year. It just gets worse and worse.
Totally.
Tech debt builds up. People walk out the door with institutional knowledge. It just like that. And that's been my experience. You know, lately I've been with the same startup/parent company for about 2 years now. And I like the people I work with. I feel like it's a compounding effect of being at the same company with the same team. And so selfishly, I want to create an environment where that can be the case, where people can work together for good periods of time. And so I look at things like, what about my day-to-day sucks?
Yes.
Like, where are the pain points? What tech debt has been building up? You know, I recently spent a lot of time redoing the onboarding for the main monorepo that it was, it wasn't maintained. And generally you would buddy up with another engineer and they would get you onboarded. And it was, it wasn't the easiest thing. And that process is always shifting of how to get all the services orchestrated together.
Yeah.
And so it was, you know, kind of like, okay, well, let's go talk to this guy. Okay. Well, maybe she knows this piece. Well, okay. Who's who?
And that sounds familiar.
Right. And so taking that into, something it's not scripted today, but it is much more straightforward. It's much more linear. It's much more repeatable. Building systems that are like that, where it's just, okay, like as a developer, I'm going to break my environment all the time. It happens. Like, I don't know, I installed some tool or I fat fingered some Git something or like, I don't know, Postgres broke and I don't know what's going on anymore. Mm-hmm. So having tools where environments can just be, you know, nuked and paved and rebuilt quickly. It's huge.
It sounds like, okay, you have this problem, but it sounds like you're iterating on it. You're making progress. But what's still persistent about the issue?
Yeah. So here's the thing. I spent a bunch of time right now working on this. in 6 months, I'm going to remember, I don't know, 60% of it, 80% of it.
Right.
In a year, I've got like fragments of memories. And maybe some people know right now that I'm working on it so they can come to me later. A bunch of people are going to forget, right?
Right.
So like, what do? You go like to the main engineering Slack channel, like at here, hey, does anybody know where this thing, who worked on this, whatever?
Oh, man.
And you know, that doesn't scale. It just turns into, nobody wants to do that, right? You don't want to ask these pesky questions. So
definitely.
Yeah, I'm exploring some strategies for like, how do we set ourselves up to be good code archaeologists?
I love that. I love that.
You know, how can I write a PR description in such a way that I can do a git blame in VS Code, hover over it, get like a nice high level description. This is what was going on in the company. This is why the ticket was written. Here's what it does. I can go into it. I can read things on the ticket. The culture is such that like the comments on PRs are healthy. They're blameless. People can question each other. People can, you know, it's not like, hey, you do this. It's more of, hey, right now it's working this way and you're writing it that way and it's going to lead to this problem. And in rereading that, I can pick up all that context. I can learn that, I being any engineer in the company. So like what, and you know, to disseminate that, it's not an easy sell. Like,
no.
There are people who will instantly buy this argument and roll with it.
Yeah.
There are also people who either don't have the time, don't have the willingness. Maybe they're sitting on some fear because of either operational things or past developer trauma or whatever it is. They don't want to really put themselves out there.
Yeah.
And so those are the questions floating in my head. Like, how do you create a good culture of people who are willing to just help each other out, like write future love letters to you know, the next engineers gonna have to come clean up the mess.
Yeah.
What does that look like?
Wow. I mean, it sounds like you have parts of the puzzle are already in your head, which is really, really good. You already identified that, hey, there's a pattern of behavior that we want to have and reinforce in a way that's positive. You know, we have empathy for each other. We have to change this code in the future. So when we do make a pull request, let's document our changes so that we can go back, understand the context of this change. And if we do need to go back and debug something, we understand why the change happened. You know, that's definitely, you know, one piece. How do you get teams to, you know, jump in on that? One of the tricks that I tend to pull with organizations that are, you know, medium sized, where there's multiple teams and everything, is you pick one team and you roll it out to them.
Yep.
They see the benefit.
Yep.
And then you hype it up to everyone else. Like, look, there's a case study. This team introduced these changes. We introduced this process on how we do our pull requests, and we've been rolling things out. And hey, by the way, the number of defects that have gone to prod, or the you know, the time it takes to resolve incidents for the service has decreased by this percent just because we have been documenting what's going on, and it makes our code easier to debug. And understand what went wrong. You know, so that is definitely one of those methods. You want to figure out a team that's open. You don't have to get everybody. You divide and conquer. Pick the teams that are open, have them roll it out, have them demonstrate the value. And then you go to those other teams, say, look what these guys are doing. This is fantastic. And then they're like, oh, okay. I already have, you know, a permission structure because this team's done it and they've done well. We'll go ahead and jump on it. You know, sometimes you need to see success for other teams for you to adopt something when you're already, you know, bogged down with work. It's all about incentives, right? There's definitely that. Another thing that comes to my mind also. So you're setting up this you know, these dev environments, and there's this constellation of relationships between them, and you're going through this process to get everything up and working. I have some good news and I have some bad news for you. The bad news is you obviously know where the pain point is. You're going to have to do it more. I think there needs to be a way where you can automate the process of standing up these environments, and you're doing it continuously and you are monitoring it. So when people are merging in code, if the process of standing up these dev environments are failing, you treat it like a production service.
Mm-hmm.
You're setting, you know, SLOs or at least some assertion that this job is going to happen every day. This job will succeed every day. And when it doesn't, we're going to drop everything and fix it because this is preventing us from being able to test our code and deliver business value.
You know, the wild thing about a system like that, I agree with you. That's internally, we've talked about setting up that exact thing.
Rock on.
With a team of 10 engineers, it makes zero sense to do that.
Right.
It's going to, I mean, you know, maybe you could set it up. But with 10 engineers, like, you know, okay, the cost of the build breaking, like, maybe it's real easy to figure out. Maybe it happens once a month. It's just not worth the squeeze. A team of 20 engineers, is it worth it? People are starting to feel the pain.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Can we hire an SRE yet? Okay, we got a team of 30 engineers, 40, 50, 100, right. 200. At 500, obviously, it makes sense to have that, right? You're going to be just the higher rate. You're going to be onboarding people that, like, okay, we definitely need it. So where is that soft point? How do you make that sale to... Like, what does that conversation look like to open up a company to say, hey, like, I hate to break it to you, but you have to spend some money right now. And it's to pay off debt that you've accumulated. And you don't even know that you've taken out this debt.
Yeah.
But you have this debt and you got to pay it off now or you're going to lose money. Like, how does that work?
Totally. What an amazing question. So you just gave me the layup. Now, hopefully I slam dunk this thing. So here's the thing. With executives or even managers or product managers, whoever has, you know, the purse strings or the control of the roadmap and what needs to be prioritized, they're thinking about two things. They're thinking about time and they're thinking about money. So if you are able to quantify the pain of, you know, the time spent to get this environment up, if you're able to quantify that and you're able to say, hey, it costs half a FTE or one FTE just for this problem, or at least a significant percentage of the collective team's time. You're then able to say, this is how much money that we're putting on fire, we're setting on fire while this issue persists. And now that very easily is grokked by the business owners, the product managers, the engineering VPs, whoever is, you know, setting tone for the organization. I'll tell you a little case study. So back to my earlier mention of running an operations team before our episode here, I had that team track their time on everything they did. And it was a pain in the butt. Definitely a pain in the butt. But what we gained was an understanding of what the team was spending their time on and how much, and being that we were breaking up our work into four types of work. I was using the Phoenix Project, by the way. That was what was in the back of my head, which was, you know, using planned work, internal projects, operational change, and unplanned work outages. By breaking it up into those four, I was then able to say, hey, C-level, this is the percentage of the team's time spent on unplanned work, meaning you're spending N FTEs on just outages, maybe we should solve these problems. And overnight, I got funding to start an SRE organization and was given funding to launch an internal tooling team. So, like, back to your example, yeah, figure out how many dollars it costs the team every time this happens. And you don't have to track all of the work that you do, you know, time-wise. You can just track the amount of time spent on the painful crap, because now you're converting engineering team sentiment, the qualitative stuff, hey, this is painful, hey, this sucks, to quantitative data. Back to your original point, all the way in the beginning of this episode, you're now extracting the data you need to make those business decisions. So if I was able to wave my magic wand and change one thing, it would be for your team to have the ability to track the amount of time you spend on that crap and then surface that to you know, the team to make their own decisions or to leadership to make those decisions. But that would be the direction I take.
So it's not just enough to have a gripe fest going on on the Engineering Monthly that this is the worst thing going on here. I hate this. I hear you. I hate it too. Yeah, it's pretty awful. But you actually got to do some tracking. And even if it's like, could it be something as simple as sending a survey out like, hey, how much time per month do you spend on this? Get some rough number and ballpark it. You know, it's between 0.75 and 1.5 FTE and throwing that up to CFO.
That's it. Then you got the data.
Cool.
Right. That would be, again, I think doing a survey would be an easy way to at least your midpoint between qualitative and quantitative. They might embellish the numbers a little bit, but you're going to approximate the amount of operational cost that Toil Source is doing. But yeah, that would be the way I go about it.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate the tip. That's a Q1 thing coming up, so I'm probably going to pick your brain on that one.
Fantastic. Rock on. So we're just about on time. This has been an amazing conversation, an amazing first episode. So, you know, what do you want? Do you have any like overarching tips? I mean, you've dumped a lot of knowledge on us. We've had a really amazing time, but do you have any advice for maybe junior engineers or teams that are having a struggle with technical debt? Like, elucidate us on your philosophy a little bit about how to address this.
There was a keynote speech given at RailsConf in 2017. I can't remember the name of the woman who gave it. The metaphor she used was that we're building code in our home.
Mm.
And when you're in your home and your home is messy, it's harder to work.
Yeah.
Maybe a little mess here and there is fine. But when you go into the kitchen and the sinks are just completely full and there's no soap and the fridge is full of rotten food and there's no clean dishes and it's just this absolute nightmare, what are you going to do? You're just going to order takeout over and over, right? And it builds up. It's expensive.
Yeah.
It's not fun. But you know, I mean, the reality is you got to work in that kitchen.
That's right.
You got to find a way to do it. And it's hard to do it. And I think juniors, they're in it's both a good spot and a bad spot in that they haven't seen a ton of environments. So they don't know if something is messy or if it's just a complicated tech stack.
Yeah, they just accept things as they are because they're junior and they're open to being told how things are rather than seeing it for themselves.
So there's a dangerous point here that, you know, being a junior, like I would recommend look for things that seem messy, but at the same time, don't call everything a mess.
Right.
Don't call everything tech debt. Don't, cause I've worked with a number of juniors who've done this where they say, oh, that's just a bunch of tech debt. That's just a bunch of tech debt. Oh, that thing, that's tech debt. Well, okay. So you're just labeling everything that's not good to you as tech debt. It's not like at some point you have to, there's momentum, right? Code has momentum over time.
Yes,
and bits and pieces of it, you have to work with. So if something looks messy, ask somebody else, hey, does this look really messy to you? Or could you help me make some sense of this? And if you get two or three people together who like, yeah, I hate working in that part of the code base. I don't know. Nobody knows how this thing's supposed to work. Like, that's a good sign if you've got a way of cleaning that up. I mean, we got ChatGPT, whatnot, right? You can ask for ways to clean up code. So there are better tools today than there were a few years ago. But I mean, the gist is like, keep your environment clean. When you're working in the kitchen, when you've got an idle moment, like wash a dish, you know, put something away, do a quick inventory in the fridge. Like, are you out of milk? Put that on the list.
That's right.
Just slowly, you know, just keep track of how much of a mess you're making, how much of a mess your team is making. Talk to them about it. Keep the conversation going.
Yeah.
And if you don't, the risk is that you can internalize this. Well, I just write messy code.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not that great. I don't really know what to do. And the reason you don't know what to do is because there's just all of this junk and nobody knows what to do, but nobody's talking about it.
100%. Yeah. I think that makes perfect sense. So just to sum up, when you are a junior, call out the sources of technical debt or the sources of pain that are significant. Don't call every little thing, but call the major stuff, the stuff that creates a pattern, the stuff that you see often, and talk about it and bring it up. You know, one of the things, just to add a little bit extra, you know, detail or extra perspective is, I think new junior engineers and especially new employees are awesome for one reason. Their mind has not been, you know, biased by working at an organization for so long that they just accept the things that are going on as, hey, this is the way that things are. So one of the things I tend to do is listen very intently to a new engineers. And when they ask a question like, why is it like that? Sometimes they will reveal things that have been, you know, in front of you for years that are actually real problems.
100%.
Yeah.
There's a name for this type of document. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but it's like anybody who's new to an organization or a team, it doesn't matter what level you're at, just keep a list of things that seem weird.
Yeah.
Things that seem like fires, things that's like I don't want to be the new guy and start saying, hey, we need to change this, we need to change that. But I do want to keep a list of stuff that just strikes me as like, I don't know if this is the best way to do it. Internally, I do this.
Yeah.
We've got a group DM going of things that, patterns that we're observing. And, you know, once a pattern shows up often enough, like, okay, maybe that's the cause of some of the toil. Like,
yeah,
this is something that could be addressed. So just take notes, like something stands out as weird, like note that it's weird. Have a conversation in the kitchen, have a conversation with a coworker after stand-up, have a conversation with your manager, have a conversation with ChatGPT even, although it's usually just going to say, oh yeah, you're right, that is awful. Let me tell you about why it's awful.
For sure.
But you know, it's, I think it's important just to stay curious.
100%. Yeah. That's amazing advice. Yeah. Thank you, Rick. I think juniors will get a lot out of that. So as we wrap up, where can we find you, if at all? I mean, you're an enigmatic guy usually after hours.
You know, I have no social presence. You can find me right here on the podcast.
All right, rock on. You know what that means? That means you're going to have to appear here again. Cool, man.
Be happy to do it.
Awesome. Well, again, Rick, thank you so much for joining me on this first episode of Reliability Rebels.
My pleasure, man. Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Thank you for listening to today's edition of Reliability Rebels. Until next time.
Check one, check two.
Reliability Rebels.
Check one, check two.
Reliability Rebels.
Check, 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 check.
Reliability Rebels.